Well, as the title suggests, we are back to the tabernacle, and we're going to look at the abundance, or overabundance, you could say, of contributions to the tabernacle, and then we'll begin to consider the construction of the curtains of the tabernacle. By way of application, I will not be asking you to go home and build curtains and form your own tabernacle at the house, but we'll consider some application points at the end. So Exodus 36 is where we'll be. I hope you can turn there in your copy of God's Word. Well, I think Victor Hamilton, in his commentary on Exodus, I think he makes a great point coming to Exodus 36. He says, "Kudos to the readers of Scripture who patiently are able to plow their way through all the micrometric details of the tabernacle in chapters 25 through 31, only to have to face an encore in chapters 35 through 39. So kudos to you guys for wading through this study and working through the second half of the tabernacle portion here in Exodus. But Hamilton goes on to offer a series of reasons why this second part of the tabernacle is crucial. In fact, he gives us four reasons. So let's look at that as we sort of lay the context for Exodus 36. So a reason for the repetition here. Hamilton argues that this highlights Moses' faithfulness in recording and narrating the material. Yeah, I mean, think about yourself and place yourself in Moses' shoes here. You know, Moses is getting all of this information from God on Sinai. He comes down from Sinai, he relays it to the people, and then as he writes the Pentateuch, specifically Exodus, I mean, he is writing this material down twice. And there isn't one error or one contradictory statement from 25 to 31, from 35 to 39. It's all harmonious. A second reason Hamilton offers for the repetition is that it contrasts that which was made regarding the golden calf and the tabernacle. You know, we made this point and we looked at this last time, comparing and contrasting what we've already seen in Exodus. Of course, those early chapters talking about Moses and enslaving the Israelites and them building buildings. But then also when you get to Exodus 32, you see that the golden calf was made. And then when you get to, of course, 35 through 39 or 35 through 40, if you want to include that final chapter, there's the great contrast of that which was made unto the Lord. Thirdly, Hamilton says that this material provides another example of promises and fulfillments in Exodus. That's one of the beauties of this book, is that God makes promises in the early chapters and then they are fulfilled. Well, God makes a promise that the tabernacle will be built in 25 through 31, they sin in 32, and then 35 through 40 shows us the fruition of the promise. God will abide with his people. And then lastly, it proves that God is not done with the nation of Israel. It would be very easy for the golden calf sin to take place in Exodus 32 and for Exodus 32 to be the final chapter in Exodus. But 35 through 40 shows us that not only has God restored his people, forgiven his people, but his plan of redemption is moving forward. So there's several reasons why this repetition is key and why we're going to study it the next few weeks in Omega. Now, that transitions us to what we're going to discover today in Exodus 36, 2 through 19. Moses narrates both the extravagant contributions of the people for the tabernacle and the craftsmen beginning construction on the curtains of the tabernacle. So those are the two main areas that we're going to focus our attention on, because that's really how the text divides it for us. We're going to look at the contributions and then the curtains of the tabernacle. Now let's begin with this first point by considering the overabundance of contributions, and we'll find that in verses 2 through 7. Now, theologically, the structure and precision of the whole narrative is a wonderful picture of the structure and precision of the physical tabernacle, right? I mean, you see all of the order, you see all of the details, and all of the ink spilt on describing the tabernacle, but that really is an indication of what type of structure the tabernacle will be. You have precise instructions so you will have a precise building. But then practically speaking, all this organization just helps us as readers get through the narrative with an understanding of what God is trying to do. So in Exodus 35, Moses relayed God's words from Sinai to the people about the articles or elements that needed to be brought by the people for the construction of the tabernacle. But the end of chapter 35 records the fulfillment of that command. So God says, you need to bring the elements, and then 35, the back half of it, Moses tells us that's exactly what happened. And then in the next section of Exodus, Moses relays God's words again about the craftsmen who were to be used to build the tabernacle. And then we saw at the beginning of chapter 36 that those craftsmen came forth, Bezalel and Aholiab. But as we'll see at the beginning here of Exodus 36, Moses breaks that pattern. He breaks that pattern to highlight the fact that the people were extravagant in their contributions, demonstrating their commitment to building a place for God to dwell and a place for God to meet with his people. So let's consider the overabundance of contributions by first looking at the craftsmen who receive the contribution. The craftsmen who receive the contribution. So these verses connect us with what we looked at last week. These two verses show the fulfillment of what was written in chapter 35, that God called Bezalel and Aholiab and others. Not only did he call them, but he filled them with the, who remembers? He filled them with the Spirit of God, and then he gave them the exact blueprint for how they would construct the tabernacle. So these two men and other skillful Israelites not only were intelligent, not only had great skill that they had learned and it had evolved during their lifetime, but they were empowered by the Spirit of God to do this. Notice verse 2, the two verbs. These men were told to come to perform the work. To come has the idea of stepping up to. It's the same word used in Exodus 40 to describe Moses approaching one of the furniture pieces of the tabernacle. The word perform, the idea there is to manufacture. It's to manufacture. In fact, that word manufacture or perform, it's the same word, and I want you to see this connection. It's the same word used in Genesis 3 to describe God making or manufacturing garments to cover Adam and Eve after they sinned. So the word choices are crucial. The skillful craftsmen are to build the greatest tabernacle, the greatest tent, the greatest portable sanctuary that has ever existed. And so that same careful, skillful craft that is supposed to be used to build the tabernacle is really a reflection of that same skillful craft that God used to craft those garments all the way back in Genesis 3, the garments that Adam and Eve wore to cover their skin. Now, as we've mentioned, the last couple weeks, the people's hearts and wills were stirred and they were compelled to participate. This is especially true of the craftsmen. Remember, thinking holistically about the entire book of Exodus, Pharaoh's heart was not moved to participate in God's plan. In fact, Pharaoh's heart, remember all of those sections throughout the plagues where we're told and given insight into Pharaoh's heart, that his heart was moved, but his heart was always moved in an antithetical way, opposed to God's plan. But here in the tabernacle section, we see all of the people's hearts, all of the people's hearts and wills stirred to be part of God's redemptive plan. And notice verse 3. Verse 3 tells us that the craftsmen received the contributions, and then those craftsmen gave those contributions to Moses. Now, why would they do that? Well, I don't think this is overly theological or anything. I think that the contributions were made by the people. I think that Bezalel and Aholiab would take those contributions. They themselves would inspect them. But then Moses would be the final one to inspect the material so he could see if it would be adequate for the building of the tabernacle. So these men receive contributions. But they quickly find out, as we'll discover in the next few verses, that the people bring a surplus of contributions. So verses 3 through 5 in this section tell us that the people keep bringing contributions. Now let's begin reading here in verse 2, and then we'll stop in verse 5. Then Moses called Bezalel and Aholiab and every skillful person in whom the Lord had put skill, everyone whose heart stirred him, to come to the work to perform it. They received from Moses all the contributions which the sons of Israel had brought to perform the work in the construction of the sanctuary. And they still continued bringing to him freewill offerings every morning. And all the skillful men who were performing all the work of the sanctuary came, each from the work which he was performing. And they said to Moses, "The people are bringing much more than enough for the construction work which the Lord commanded us to perform." So as we just saw in the text, these verses teach that extravagant giving characterized this newly restored nation. Not only did they bring freewill offerings and contributions, they kept bringing them over and above, beyond. And it's interesting to think about, and I won't have you turn there, but you're familiar with the story. In Exodus 32 at the golden calf, although the people did bring materials, nowhere in Exodus 32 are they described as being extravagant, bringing an overabundance. They were compelled by their own hearts to bring an exact supply, but in the tabernacle, moved by the Spirit of God, people were compelled to bring more than enough. There's only two verses in the golden calf section that talk about contributions, but here in chapter 35 and 36, there are at least a dozen verses that tell us about the contributions. See, it's crucial, and we've talked about this as we've studied Genesis and Exodus. We've really spent about 3 years in Old Testament narrative. What's important to understand as you read through Old Testament narrative in your own time is that, of course, you want to do a careful exegesis of each individual word, that literal, grammatical, historical hermeneutic. You want to keep that. But you also want to look at how the information is being conveyed to us. So it would do us all well to read Exodus 32 and then to read this tabernacle portion to compare and contrast and see how much more important this section of Exodus is. Look at verse 5. And they, the craftsmen, said to Moses, "The people are bringing much more than enough for the construction work which the Lord commanded us to perform." Now I love what happens here. So on the one hand, Moses narrates that all the people are doing what? They're bringing contributions. But then he switches from just giving us the narration to now giving us explicit dialogue. And another Hebrew narrative tip is that the plot moves through dialogue. So when you read the Old Testament, look for the dialogue. That gives us insight to what's happening. So here we have dialogue. The people are bringing much more than enough for the construction. That's key. Douglas Stewart writes, "It would not be going too far to suggest that the people were here described as highly enthusiastic about the project, recognizing in it the opportunity to begin keeping the covenant correctly as opposed to their prior gross disobedience." So this is a good problem to have. The people are being overabundant. They're providing a surplus of goods to build the tabernacle. Well, next we'll see Moses' response to the contributions. Moses' response to the contributions. That's in verse 6. So Moses issued a command, and a proclamation was circulated throughout the camp, saying, "Let no man or woman any longer perform work for the contributions of the sanctuary." So to deal with the joyful hearts and the overabundance of offerings, Moses issues a command. He gives an explicit instruction. He gives an order. The text says proclamation. Literally, that means voice. Moses made his voice known throughout the entire camp. And the idea behind circulated, we understand that today, but the idea behind circulated is that an announcement was being transmitted from person to person. It's the same word used in the Old Testament of wind passing over an area. So Moses makes a proclamation like the wind. He makes a proclamation that goes throughout the 2 million people there, and that proclamation is simply this: stop contributing to the tabernacle. Thank you, but not anymore. We have what we need. Remember, the tabernacle has specific dimensions. It's a specific size. So an abundance of material, it's pointless. Now, Moses doesn't say it like that. That's my translation of it. But that's essentially what Moses is getting at here. We have all we need. The supplies are here. The elements are here. We have all of the workers. We don't need anything else. Let's look at verse 6. Let no man or woman any longer perform work for the contributions of the sanctuary. Again, dialogue. That's key. We have the exact words that were announced to the nation of Israel. But notice how this section ends. It ends with the narrator's evaluation of the contributions. The narrator's evaluation of the contributions. Now, I've already mentioned some Hebrew reading tips. I know you want one more, so I'm going to give you one more. When you're reading Hebrew narrative, you also want to look for when the narrator gives us a comment about the story. Okay, so you could call that a narrator comment, or I think that it might be more helpful to say it this way, an evaluative comment. In other words, the narrator is going to give his evaluation of the scene. Now, these don't happen all the time, but when these comments do come up in the text, you've got to lock in on them. They are key to understanding. The narrator is trying to frame your thinking. Now, one of the most common narrator comments here, and we're moving out of Exodus for this example, and that's okay, is in Judges, there was no king in Israel, for everyone did what? See, you know that narrator comment. That's great. That's an evaluative comment. That is the author of Judges telling us, hey, look, let me summarize what's happening in the book of Judges, right? That's what we're all familiar with. That's important. Well, here we get the narrator's evaluation of the contributions. I love that. Look at verse 6. Thus the people were restrained from bringing any more. So the narrator is commenting. Look, everyone's restrained. No one's bringing more. Verse 7. For the material they had was sufficient. It was enough. And more than enough for all the work to perform it. So again, these narrator comments are highly significant. Let me give you one more. Earlier, or the last few weeks, I've been reading through 1 Samuel in the morning, and the other morning I came across 1 Samuel 26, and you'll remember when David goes into the camp at night, and he goes right next to Saul's head, and he takes Saul's spear and a jug of water. That's amazing, right? Like, how in the world was David able to do that? I understand that he's crafty, he's good at what he does. There's no way my wife could sneak up on me in bed. I wake up to anything, by the way. What's interesting is after that happens, the narrator comments and said it was the Lord Yahweh who caused a deep sleep to fall on everybody in the camp. It's amazing. So these narrator comments, they're crucial. They're key. That's what we have here. The people were restrained. They were kept back. That's the same word used in the flood narrative in Genesis of God keeping back the waters from falling from the sky. It's amazing. There was sufficient elements, sufficient goods. None needed to be brought. And the narrator says, it's enough. It's enough. We have enough. So that's the overabundance of the contributions. I know you're waiting for this. The construction of the curtains. The construction of the curtains. This is the second half of our time this morning. I'm going to read all of the text, verses 8 through 19, and then we'll just make a few comments about the curtains. Verse 8. All of the skillful men among those who were performing the work made the tabernacle with 10 curtains of fine twisted linen and blue and purple and scarlet material, with cherubim, the work of a skillful workman, Bezalel, made them. So now we get insight about what Bezalel made in particular. Verse 9, the length of each curtain was 28 cubits and the width of each curtain 4 cubits. All the curtains had the same measurements. He joined 5 curtains to one another, and the other 5 curtains he joined to one another. He made loops of blue on the edge of the outermost curtain in the first set. He did likewise on the edge of the curtain that was outermost in the second set. He made 50 loops in the one curtain, and he made 50 loops on the edge of the curtain that was in the second set. The loops were opposite each other. He made 50 clasps of gold and joined the curtains to one another with the clasps, so the tabernacle was a unit. Verse 14. Then he made curtains of goat's hair for a tent over the tabernacle. He made 11 curtains in all. The length of each curtain was 30 cubits and 4 cubits the width of each curtain. The 11 curtains had the same measurements. He joined 5 curtains by themselves and the other 6 curtains by themselves. Moreover, he made 50 loops on the edge of the curtain that was outermost in the first set, and he made 50 loops on the edge of the curtain that was outermost in the second set. He made 50 clasps of bronze to join the tent together so that it would be a unit. He made a covering for the tent of ram skins dyed red and a covering of porpoise skins above. Now let's stop there. Now, the verses we read together, they should sound familiar because they are almost verbatim with what was written in 26, 1 through 14 in the instruction for the tabernacle section. Now that we're back in the tabernacle, I want to remind ourselves of what the tabernacle looked like and how it was to be constructed. And to do this, I just want to work our way from the inside out. This will help orient our mind with the tabernacle proper again, and then this will help sort of set in view the several curtains here that we'll examine in just a moment. But starting all the way from the inside was the most holy place, or the Holy of Holies, which was 15 feet by 15 feet by 15 feet. And in this room, this small room, was the Ark of the Covenant. And this is where God would descend and he would dwell and he would place his feet, as it were, on the mercy seat. Now remember, all of these elements, all of the pieces of furniture in the most holy place and the holy place are gold. So that Ark of the Covenant was acacia wood and it was overlaid with gold. And only the high priest could enter once a year. The next room that we find in the tabernacle is the holy place, which was 30 feet long by 15 feet wide by 15 feet high. You'll remember the pieces of furniture in there. It contains the altar of incense, the table of showbread, and the golden lampstand. Remember, everything in that room was overlaid with gold, and only the priests could enter. Only the priest could enter. So watch the flow there. In the most holy place, only the high priest could enter once a year. Then in the holy place, the other room of the tabernacle proper, only the priest could enter. They were allowed to go in there daily. Now, that takes us to the courtyard, which was 150 feet long by 75 feet wide. Or 150 feet long, 75 feet wide, and it had the 30-foot gate. And it contained the bronze altar and the bronze laver. Remember, there were only 2 pieces of furniture out in this courtyard. And notice how the elements shifted. Everything closer to God's presence in the most holy place is gold. The holy place is also gold. Then when you get to the courtyard, it's all made of bronze. Remember, the further away that you're getting from God's presence is the shifting and changing of the elements used for the furniture. Everything there was overlaid with bronze. But in this courtyard section, all of the Israelites could enter. They could all come into the courtyard. Now, of course, they didn't do that at one time because 2 million people lived there and you couldn't get 2 million people into the courtyard, but they could have access there. Now, the entrance of the tabernacle you can see here would be from the east side. It would be from the east side. Now, it was crucial, and I hope you remember this. If not, I'm going to remind you that when Adam and Eve were banished out of the garden, remember, they were banished east, away from God's presence. And that's how that narrative in Genesis, that's the direction that you see people moving. They're going east. But with the tabernacle, you enter through the east and you go west. You're coming back to God's presence. That's why it faced that particular way. It's connecting us with the Garden of Eden. So you would enter through the tabernacle. Again, the curtains would be pulled back there. You can see the picture there. That was 30 feet wide. And that's where you would enter in to the courtyard. Now, surrounding the tabernacle was the tribe of Levi. So remember, the tabernacle is in the center of all of the tribes, and the Levites were camped around the tabernacle. And Moses' family and Aaron's family, they were camped on the east side in front of the entrance. The book of Numbers describes all of this. But you can see here that all of the tribes were then stationed around the tabernacle. In other words, the tabernacle proper was the focal point of the camp. It was right in the middle. So when God would come down and meet with the people, he would come to the middle of the camp. And by the way, the surrounding nations would have been outside the camp. So you can just see there, based on how people are situated around the tabernacle, who was able to have access to God. Remember, it was God that chose this particular people in Genesis 12. He builds on that covenant in Exodus 19. But you notice, all of the people can come around the tabernacle, in terms of Israelites. All of the people can get into the courtyard, but only Levitical priests, specifically Aaron's sons, can get into the holy place, and only Aaron himself can come into the Holy of Holies. That is the tabernacle. Douglas Stewart, he makes a helpful comment here. Everything making up the tabernacle and its courtyard could be rather quickly disassembled, wrapped or bundled up, and transported as the Israelites moved from place to place before settling in Canaan. It could also be reassembled rather quickly whenever they set up camp. Thus, as the Israelites moved, God moved with them. Wherever they went, he lived in their midst. That's just amazing, right? So for the next 40 years, the tabernacle is going to be set up. It's going to be disassembled. They're going to move. Set up, disassembled, they're going to move. And at every point where they are going, God himself is going with them. And then once they finally make it to the promised land, right? In those early chapters of Joshua, remember when they cross over the Jordan River, right? The Ark of the Covenant leading the way. They will set up the tabernacle, and the tabernacle will be the point of worship until the temple is built, right? Several hundred years later. So that's just an overview of the tabernacle, a refresher. Let's look at the curtains now. Let's see the repeated elements that we find in these two sections. The repeated elements about the curtains in these two sections. Well, the first one is the single inner curtain. The single inner curtain. What we find is that four curtains were used to cover the tabernacle proper. The most important of the four curtains was this single inner curtain. Here's just an idea of what that potentially could have looked like. Moses didn't leave us any drawings. He just left us some words here. So we don't know exactly, but here's the idea. So the inner curtain of the tabernacle measured 42 feet long and 6 feet wide, and its primary function was to line both the walls and the ceilings of the tabernacle. The wall and the ceiling of the tabernacle. Exodus 36:8 tells us that these curtains were made of fine linen, and this is that the single inner curtain. It was made of fine linen mixed with yarns that had been dyed blue, purple, and scarlet. This curtain was ornate. It had twisted linen. It had cherubim on it. Now, five of the curtains were joined together, so there would be two sets of five curtains. Again, each set was 42 feet long and 30 feet wide. These two sets of curtains were then connected through 50 loops. And since this is inside the tabernacle, what type of element do you think was used? Gold. So it was connected through 50 loops and 50 gold rings or clasps. And this curtain would have served as the primary ceiling, and it would have been draped over the north and south walls and the west wall, but of course not over the east wall, because that's where the veil would have been, and that's next Sunday's study. But again, this is the most important of the curtains. It's the most intricate. It's the most ornate. And it is this way, brothers and sisters. It is crafted this way because it is the closest to God's presence. That's the key. It's ornate because it's closest to God's presence. So this single inner curtain was critical. Well, another repeated element are the three protective curtains. Three protective curtains. The first was made of goat hair and functioned as a protective barrier for the innermost curtain. This curtain was most likely one color, and it was obviously larger than the innermost curtain to protect it from the elements and to veil or screen people from seeing in. Whereas the inner curtain had two sets of five curtains, this first protective curtain had one set of five and one set of six. Now, I think there are theological and practical reasons for that, right? I mean, if this curtain's going to cover the other one, and we're sure it's going to cover the other one, it needs to be practically a little what? Yeah, a little bigger, okay? So that would be helpful. The inner curtain was connected through 50 loops and gold rings, but this first protective curtain had 50 loops and bronze rings, okay? So again, you can see the elements shifting here. This metal is less valuable as it moves away from the presence of God. The second protective covering was made of ram skins that were dyed red or possibly tan. And then the third and final protective covering was made of porpoise skins. Vern Poitras, he says, "We cannot be certain of the character of the outermost covering because there is an unusual key word." So you can go back and read all of the commentaries. You can read all of the articles to try and figure out what animal skin was used here. We don't know. We don't know. The idea is that this final layer was the best possible material to protect the tabernacle proper from all of the elements and the wear and tear of taking the tabernacle apart, but also the tabernacle being set up in all of the wilderness elements. And by the way, these three protective curtains not only protected the innermost curtain and the furniture inside the tabernacle, which was key, right? I mean, that would be awful if they made all of these pieces of furniture and then there was no coverings and everything just got wrecked for the next 500 years. It wouldn't make any sense. So there's a practical reason, but all of these coverings ensured that people could not see in. People could not see in because not everybody was granted access to the tabernacle. Now, let's talk about the function of the tabernacle, or the function of the curtains, rather, in three different ways. Theologically, the curtains were manufactured in a way to reflect their proximity to God. Remember, the most ornate was the innermost. The most plain was the outermost. Theologically, this identified the presence of God. Ceremonially, the curtains were used to keep people out, because no one can stand in the presence of God without a mediator and a sacrifice. They kept people out, and this was good. These curtains just kept people from the wrath and judgment of God. This is helpful. This is for their own safety. So ceremonially, these curtains were key. And then lastly, practically, the curtains just ensured the tabernacle will survive. It provided stability and protection. So those are the similarities between the two accounts. You look at 25 to 31 and 36 through 40, those are the similarities that you find in the curtains. Let's look at some of the differences. Some of the differences. Not many here, but just let me give you three differences. The first difference that we find between the instructions for the tabernacle and the construction of the tabernacle related to the curtains, the first one is that in chapter 26, there's a command to make the curtains. You shall make or you will make, but in chapter 36, the text conveys the idea of past tense. They did make the curtains. This is good. Another difference is, rather than including all of the minor details, Moses actually holds off on some of the minor details, and he just summarizes all of the information here. This is good. And then third difference, in the instructions for the tabernacle, the furniture pieces inside the tabernacle are described before the curtains. And I love this. Again, think of how all of the information is being given to us. In the instructions for the tabernacle, 25 through 31, the first element, the first furniture, anything about the tabernacle, the first and primary furniture piece that was mentioned in that section is the Ark of the Covenant. That is front and center in 25 through 31. But then when you get to 36 through 50, the Ark of the Covenant doesn't come first, but it's the curtains. Well, this makes sense in the arrangement of the material. We need to have the tabernacle before we can put things in it. So that's another difference that you see here. Now, let's finish our time this morning with just appropriating the verses that we just considered. The appropriation of 36, 2 through 19. And I like using the word appropriation because I want us to think of how this text can just alter and change our thinking, how it can stir our heart, right? I don't want to just give you, hey, go out and do this, right? Go build some curtains with your spouse this week, right? Some ornate ones and then just, you know, some plain, you know, coverings to keep water. No, I'm not going to give you that to go and do. If you do that, send me a picture. That's great. But I want you to think of how the concepts and the principles here can be mapped onto your life. You know, how can we leave here and just be gripped by what we just read and to live differently because of it? So just let me offer you two to consider. One, the people's generous contributions for the tabernacle provide a timeless giving principle for God's people to be a cheerful giver. Now, I understand in the Old Testament that tithes were critical because it was the tithing of the people that would fund the Levitical work, particularly with the temple, right? So we get there were set amounts that people needed to give. But when you come to the New Testament, there isn't a set amount that anybody is required to give. The New Testament just emphasizes that we as God's people should be cheerful givers. That's 2 Corinthians, really, chapter 7 through 9. Be a cheerful giver. So we're commanded to give as an act of worship, but we're not given a specific amount, and that's okay. You determine an amount in your own heart, and then you give that to the local church. You do that primarily, but you can also associate yourself with other parachurch ministries and those things. But we don't want to begrudgingly give, right? You know, if you do that online, you just hit the submit button, you're like, oh, man. Or, you know, you drop it in the offering slot in the back and you just hang your head over to Omega until you get some coffee, you know? We don't want to do that. We want God to cultivate in our heart to be cheerful givers, okay? I think that's one principle we can apply. And then lastly, the curtains for the tabernacle reveal the barrier between holy God and sinful people, thus our need for a high priest. And brothers and sisters, if we were alive during this time, We're not getting in. We aren't getting into the tabernacle, right? And neither did a majority of the people. They had to rely on Aaron and the high priesthood to do all the sacrifices, to do all the work, and to go into the most holy place on the Day of Atonement in Leviticus 16 and make sacrifice for the people. They did that constantly and all the time, sacrifice after sacrifice, priest after priest. They themselves never had access to God fully, right? I mean, we understand they were around the camp. They saw God descend, those things. But we have a high priest, right? That's our Lord Jesus Christ. That is the book of Hebrews. That's the central theme of Hebrews, Christ as our great high priest. Brothers and sisters, we have access to God any time we want. Which, by default, by implication, we need to go to him often, right? I mean, his throne room is open for us. He hears our prayers, Psalm 34. And he has granted us access through his life, death, and his resurrection. That ought to grip us and move us. So that is the contributions. And that is the construction of the curtains for the tabernacle. Next time, we'll consider the veils of the tabernacle. Let's pray together. God, we are grateful for your word. Grateful for challenging passages like this that teach us about what happened so many years ago in the wilderness, on how the tabernacle was to be built so you could dwell and meet with your people. God, we are on the other side of the new covenant where you dwell richly within us by your Spirit. What a profound reality. God, may we take full advantage of your presence all through Christ. In his name we pray. Amen.